All right, we'll be continuing today in our multi-part series of sermons on Abraham. We've come to chapter 18, so let's just begin right there, chapter 18 of the book of Genesis. As with so many of these chapters, I think it's just chocked full of information and helpful lessons as we take the time to consider everything that we read there. We start out reading about a terebinth tree, whatever that is. It says in verse 1, Genesis 18 and verse 1, "Then the Eternal appeared to him by the terebinth trees of Mamre, as he was sitting at the tent door of the heat of the day." Now, this is not the main point of the sermon by any means, but I was asked about that. What's a terebinth tree? And I did a little bit of research. You could do the same type of research, but there seem to be three schools of thought. It seems like nobody really is absolutely sure what that means, a terebinth tree. There are three theories about what it means. One is that it's a type of very large oak tree, maybe that could get as high as 30, 40, 50 feet high, just a majestic large oak tree that could provide a lot of shade. And so that's one possibility. A terebinth tree is just an untranslated word from the Hebrew, or it's a reference to just a large, stately oak tree. A second theory is that it really is describing a certain type of large bush that can get large enough to almost seem like a tree. It's a bush that produces pistachio and or cashew nuts, that family of shrubs that produces those kinds of nuts, two of my favorite snacks, actually, pistachios and cashews. But it's a bush that could, it's larger than a little bush. It could be as high as 10 or even 12 feet high. And in fact, if you Google terebinth, that you might get a picture of that possible answer. A large shrub or bush that can produce either pistachio, different kinds of them, nuts, pistachio or cashew tree. Or the third theory among those who study these things is that, you know, there's another place where other places where it talks about terebinth trees, and there are different descriptions. This one says the terebinth tree of Mamre. In another place, it talks about the terebinth trees of Morah. Morah means teacher. And so there is a school of thought, and some scholars have said, well, it just means a teaching tree. You know, in ancient times, there might have been, and in this part of the world, there might have been an acknowledged village wise man or elder who would have set up a teaching shop under the shade of a tree. And it really isn't a type of vegetation, but more just a description of this is where you went to get lessons from this elder, maybe Morah. So it's a teaching tree. I don't read anything that is absolutely definitive on that. To me, it makes most sense that it probably is that first explanation, a large, stately oak tree that could provide a lot of shade. There were groves or stands of these trees in times past in Canaan. So whatever it means of those three, this is where God, it says, appeared. The Eternal appeared to him by the terebinth trees of Mamre, or of Mamre, as he was sitting in the tent door in the heat of the day. Now, again, if it was a large, stately tree with a lot of foliage on it, it makes sense that it would be a shady place, and it might be a place you would put your tent. You'd have two shades. You'd have the shade from the leaves of this stately tree, and then the flap of your tent if it was up on poles, and you could be under that and you'd get a shade a couple of ways. Whatever, that seems to be the best I could come up with in researching that. Now this appearance by God to Abraham, verse 1 of chapter 18, is actually the fifth time that we are told that God appeared to, in one way or another, either in a dream or in a vision or just bodily, you know, it was the fifth time that he has appeared and communicated directly to Abram or Abraham after the first time when he was still back in the place of his birth, which was clear back in Ur of the Chaldees. There was that first appearance, and then there have been five since then, and this is the fifth. And this series has been going on a good number of weeks now. And so I thought I would, before we get into the heart of chapter 18, we do a little review of that first time back in Ur of the Chaldees when God communicated with Abram, indirectly Terah his father, Nahor his brother, Sarai his wife, and Lot. But that was back in Ur of the Chaldees. That was, call that communication number zero, well, before they ever left their homeland. But then there have been 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 since then. First of all, I want us to go back and remind ourselves. Everything God did in the life of Abram and Abraham that is recorded, I think, is rich in teaching value for us. It's very information and lesson-rich material. And I want us to remind ourselves, we went over it kind of quickly a number of weeks ago, what the spiritual or the knowledge state of this family was when God first began to communicate with them. Did they already know God? Well, actually, just the opposite. God reached down into an idolatrous, pagan family and started working with this man and other relatives to develop the covenant seed line. They were not already converted. They did not already know God. So let's go back to Revelation number 1, or communication, or 0, before we even have these five numbered ones, after they came into the promised land. But the very first time, back in Ur of the Chaldees, Genesis 11. I just want to review those and then see what the Bible says about the spiritual state of this family when God first began to work with them. And you can, I think, draw the obvious connection to what is the state of people even today and for the last 2,000 years in the church. What kind of people does God begin to work with? It's quite enlightening. Genesis 11 was where this starts, and verse 31. So let's just read this. This was when it all began in this family. This is Genesis 11 and verse 31. Now the patriarch is named Terah. This is Abram's father. Terah took his son Abram and his grandson Lot, the son of Haran. That would have been one of his children. So Lot was one of the children of one of Terah's children, but a grandson of Terah. And his daughter-in-law Sarai, his son Abram's wife, and they went out with them from Ur of the Chaldees. This was when God first appeared to Abram in Ur of the Chaldees. His father was still alive. His father was still nominally the head of the tribe. And they were called to leave Ur of the Chaldees. This is probably when Abram was 70 years old. He's already married. And it's mentioned early on that his wife Sarai was barren, verse 30. So already we're introduced to that notion, that there is a childless couple. There is a little bit of ambiguity or uncertainty about Sarai. Some of the evidence we have is that she is the daughter of Terah by another woman than Abram's mother. It might be possible that Sarai is Terah's daughter by another woman besides Abram's mother. That would make him and her half-brother and half-sister. And the evidence for that is something that is told or said later in the story that we haven't gotten to yet, in Genesis 20 and verse 12, where it says, "She indeed is truly my sister. She's the daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother." That would lend us to think that she was a half-sister. There is other evidence that she is the daughter of Haran, Abraham's dead brother. This would make her Abram's niece. And as I say, if you read the research and the scholars, they seem to be divided between those two opinions. The first one seems easiest to tie in with what I just said, Genesis 20, verse 12, that they were half-sisters by two different mothers, but the same, or they were half-brother and sister by two different mothers, but the same father, Terah. Well, anyway, things were different. The The written prohibition against marrying certain close relatives wasn't given until much later by God through Moses at Sinai. And I don't know this for certain, but what we've learned in recent decades about genetics could make that make sense, that inbreeding with very close relatives increases the likelihood that harmful mutations would show up in offspring after the human genome had degenerated after a number of centuries. I mean, where did Cain get a wife? Well, obviously he had to marry a sister, another child of Adam and Eve. But there hadn't been centuries and centuries and centuries of mutations and genetic decay in those early days. So certain things were permitted in earliest times that were prohibited later, and that might help us understand why that is. So whether this is in fact a niece of Abram, that is Sarah, or a half-sister, we have this information. All right, so that was when they were first dealt with by God when they lived in Ur of the Chaldees, which later became part of the area of Babylon. Now, what was their spiritual state when this happened? Let's go into the New Testament to the book of Acts. I might have covered this very speedily when we first went over this, but I just want to bring a few of these verses together to set the stage here. Acts chapter 7, when God first appeared to Abram, when he still lived in Ur of the Chaldees, and to his father indirectly, Terah, and all these other relatives, what did they already know about God? What was their religious background? Acts chapter 7. Let's look at verses 1 through 4. This is the famous defense or sermon or lecture by Stephen, at the end of which he lost his life because he so enraged some of his listeners by pointing out their sinfulness. But anyway, here we are in Acts 7, verse 1. Then the high priest said, "Are these things so?" Various accusations have been made about what Stephen was saying. So he said, "Men and brethren," verse 2 of Acts 7, "listen, the God of glory appeared to our father Abraham when he was in Mesopotamia." This is not when he was in Haran, which was that halfway part. This was clear back in Ur of the Chaldees, as it says here. God appeared to Abram, or Abraham, when he was in Mesopotamia before he dwelt in Haran. Well, before he dwelt in Haran was when he was still in Ur of the Chaldees. "And said to him, get out of your country." And some of the scholars would tell us that that word country, that Greek word that's translated country, or at least here, can mean birth nation, area of your nativity. So that's further evidence that Abram was born in Ur. Get out of your nativity land, your country, and from your relations, and come to a land that I will show you. Then he came out of the land of the Chaldeans and dwelt in Haran. So the first appearance by God into this family was in Ur of the Chaldees, and it was focused on Abraham. Again, I repeat it several times. His father was still alive, yes. He still honored his father. He still was accompanied by his father, or vice versa. But God's focus was on Abraham all along. Now, then let's go to another verse that adds a little bit of additional detail. Joshua, the book of Joshua, chapter 24. All right, Joshua chapter 24, first few verses. This is Joshua recounting the history of this whole plan that God is working through this family. It has now become a whole nation, and he's now the head of that nation physically, Moses having died. But here we are, Joshua 24, verse 1. "Then Joshua gathered all the tribes of Israel to Shechem and called for the elders of Israel and for their heads, for their judges, and for their officers. And they presented themselves before God." And so now Joshua begins a history lesson. "Joshua said to all the people, 'Thus says the eternal God of Israel, your fathers, including Terah," that would be Abraham's father again, "the father of Abraham and the father of Nahor," one of Abraham's brothers, "dwelt on the other side of the river," capital R, the Euphrates, over in Babylon area, dwelt on the other side of the river in old times, and they served other gods. They were pagans. They were idolaters. They weren't worshiping the true God when he first revealed himself to them in Ur of the Chaldees. It says very clearly, they served other gods. They were brought out of an idolatrous pagan background. Verse 3, then I took your father, Abraham, from the other side of the river, again the Euphrates, no doubt, and led him through all the land of Canaan and multiplied his descendants and gave him Isaac. We go down to verse 14, later in the same chapter, and it's emphasized again. Verse 14 of Joshua 24, now therefore fear the Eternal, serve him in sincerity and in truth, and put away the gods which your fathers served on the other side of the river and in Egypt. Serve the Eternal. So there was just this invisible magnetic attraction to these people, to idols. It had gone clear back into Ur of the Chaldees. This is hundreds of years later. I mean, think of this. This is after the people have been brought out of slavery in Egypt, 40 years of wilderness wandering. They've seen multiple miracles by God, and in their tents, when Moses isn't looking, and they think they can get away with it, they're still worshiping privately the same gods that their great-great-great-great-grandparents, including Terah and Abram, no doubt, had worshipped back in the beginning. They had this weakness for idols. It's inexplicable other than to say it's just a spiritual weakness of these people. Verse 15 says, and if it seems evil to you to serve the Eternal, choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve, whether, and here it is for the third time, the gods which your fathers served that were on the other side of the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell, but as for me and my house, we will serve the Eternal. Go to another place that adds a little bit of additional information for us as we set it up for chapter 18 of Genesis, Nehemiah chapter 9. Nehemiah, another servant of God, Nehemiah, giving a retrospective summary of the whole plan that God has been working out through this family, the promised seed. So here's Nehemiah giving a history lesson. Nehemiah chapter 9. Of course, this is actually a prayer, he says, before the people. Nehemiah 9 and verse 7. You are the eternal God who chose Abram and brought him out of Ur of the Chaldees. Now, the point here is you chose not Terah, but you chose Abram. The focus was always on one man, even of that small tribal group. The focus was not on Abram's brothers. It was not on Sarah. It wasn't on Lot. And it wasn't on Terah. The focus was on one man, Abram. We read that the first time we started this series. I chose Abram alone, when he was alone. God started out with the smallest unit, one man, and everything else developed from that. Chose Abram and brought him out of Ur of the Chaldees and gave him the name Abraham. And then one more thing here, Genesis 39. This is all taking us back to that one that I've labeled the zero time, because the five numbered times came after this, after Abram had come into the promised land. But this is back in Ur. Genesis 31, verse 19. It's talking about the same family. Now, the entire family did not go to Haran or then on to Canaan. Some of them stopped in Haran and set up their lives there. That was that halfway point that we read about. But some of them stayed there, halfway between Ur of the Chaldees and Canaan. And that family later comes back into the story. So this is Genesis 31, the part of the family that did not move on to Canaan. Genesis 31 and verse 19. Now Laban had gone to shear his sheep, and Rachel had stolen the household idols. This family, long after Abram has already moved on to Canaan, the part of the family that stayed back, they're still involved in idolatry, idol worship. Rachel had stolen the household idols that were her father's. And then we go to verse 34. Now Rachel had taken the household idols and put them in the camel's saddle and sat on them. And Laban searched all about the tent, but did not find them. Here's what one scholar says about these verses. We were talking about Laban and so on. Laban, the son of Bethuel, the brother of Rebekah, and the father of Leah and Rachel. The elder branch of the family remained back in Haran. They did not go with Abram to Canaan once Abram's father Terah died. The elder branch of the family remained back in Haran when Abraham removed to the land of Canaan. And it is there that we first meet with Laban as taking the leading part in the betrothal of his sister Rebekah to her cousin Isaac. So when it comes time for Abram to find a wife for his son Isaac, he says, I don't want any of these Canaanites marrying my son Isaac. So he sent the servant, you remember the story, back to Haran to this family group that had stayed back there to find a wife for Isaac. All right, so Laban again had gone to shear the sheep. I read that. Rachel had stolen the household idols. Rachel had taken the housewife. So this family had a long history and future of idolatry. So now let's go back with that is when God first spoke to Abram in Ur of the Chaldees. And now let's pick up the five times, the five revelations of God and communications with God, culminating with this fifth one in Genesis 18. A very brief review of those. We go to Genesis chapter 12. And there's an important thing to notice here. I'm going to say, number one, the first of five times when God appeared and communicated to Abraham after coming into Canaan, the first of those five is Genesis 12, verse 7. Genesis 12, verse 7. The Eternal appeared to Abram and said to your descendants, I will give this land. He's now obviously in Canaan. He says, this land you're in right now, this is the promised land. This is the first time that he appeared to Abram once he came into the promised land. To your descendants, I will give this land. And there he built an altar to the Eternal who had appeared to him. So we don't see from this point on Abram having household idols. That was what he left behind in Ur and Haran. He keeps building altars to the true God multiple times. He built an altar to the Eternal. So he has really developed in his relationship with the Creator God. He either doesn't have this same predisposition toward idols, or he's overcome it. I mean, maybe some combination of the two. Well, if I'm calling that the first time that God communicated to him once he came into the promised land, what are we going to do with verse 1 of this same chapter? Let's go back to verse 1 of the same chapter. Here it says the Eternal had said to Abram, had said. This is the past perfect. This is a reference back to that time zero when he was still back in Ur of the Chaldees. So verse 1 of chapter 12 is a retrospective back to the original time, like we read about in Acts and in those other instances. The Eternal had said to Abram, get out of your country, your nativity land. That was quoted in Acts chapter 7. From your kindred and from your father's house to a land that I will show you, and I'll make of you a great nation and all that. That was the first time God appeared to him back in Ur. All right, so time number one in Canaan was verse 7 here. At that point, Abram is probably 75 years old. He has been in Haran for 5 years, most likely. And his father has just died. And now he goes on to Canaan, and God appears to him. The second of these five appearances of God to Abram is chapter 13, verses 14 through 17. So let's look at that again. Chapter 13. Now this is after the ill-fated trip down into Egypt, and he had to lie about his wife and got in all kinds of trouble and had to get bailed out of trouble. So after that, God appears to him again. Genesis 13. This is the second occurrence after coming into the promised land. The Eternal said to Abram, after Lot had separated from him, lift up your eyes now and look from the place where you are, north, south, east, and west, and all the land which you see I give to you and to your descendants forever, and I will make your descendants as the dust of the earth. Now there's a theme we've seen both in what was said back in Ur and what was said when he first came into the land, chapter 12, verse 7, and what is said here. And when God repeats things over and over again, what should bubble to the surface is this must really be important. This must be essential. And not only what was said back in Ur, but what was said in 12:7 and what's said here, what are these common elements? You're going to be a great nation. There's going to be a lot of descendants come from you. And what's the other common theme that we see? At the time he heard these words from God, he had precisely zero descendants. So from the beginning, Abram has to make a choice. Am I going to believe the words of God, or am I going to believe what my eyes see? What is the greater reality, the words of God or what my eyes see in the present? The just shall live by faith, not by sight. Again and again, he hears the words of God, and then he looks around and he sees nothing, and he has to decide, who am I going to believe? Well, that's something that you and I still deal with. So, blessings of many descendants when at that time there were absolutely zero descendants. There's also this theme, I will bless those who bless you and curse him who curses you. This is a very important lesson, not only for the first fruits, but for humanity at large. It's simply this. God can distribute his blessings the way he chooses to. And if we think of God distributing blessings to all the world, let's say all the nations are at the end of a large pipe through which God causes to flow all these blessings. And if they'll just line up at the end of the pipe and hold out their vesicles, they can get all kinds of blessings. But what do people do? They focus on the pipe and say, God, I want to be the pipe. How come he gets to be the pipe? How come he gets to be the conduit through which you give blessing? And people challenge God's right to bless through whom he will bless. And so Abram and his descendants, the promised seed, have had to deal with jealousy from the original times until now. All the Israels of God, whether it's the nation of Israel, the family of Abraham, the church of God, which is the spiritual Israel of God, are the conduits through which God blesses the world. But oftentimes the world ignores the blessings, the potential blessings, and focuses on the conduit and says, God, you're playing favorites. I'm just as good as he is. Why can't we be the pipe? And it's just like children in a playground or in a sandbox throwing sand at each other, taking their eyes off what's really important and challenging God's ability to use whatever conduit he wants to. But not only does God say, I'll bless him who blesses you, I will curse him who curses you. At the end of the day, there will be consequences for attacking God's chosen vesicle, in this case, the family of Abraham and the promised seed. The third of these three appearances after coming into the promised land is in chapter 15, the first few verses. Verse 1 says, after these things, the word of the Eternal came to Abram in a vision, saying, do not be afraid. That's another common theme we see as God deals with Abram and with his first fruits down through time. There's plenty that could make you afraid, but don't give in to fear. Believe God as your guardian and your custodian, and he will look after you in his way. Are you going to trust God? Am I going to trust God? Is Abraham going to trust God or not? He says, don't be afraid. So this chapter 15 was right after rescuing Lot and meeting Melchizedek and having an interaction with the king of Sodom. He wanted nothing to do with Sodom. Sodom was already known for its sinfulness even then. Abram didn't want anything to do with it. The only interest he had in Sodom at that point was that's where his nephew Lot lived. The fourth of these five is all of chapter 17, which we read last time. The additional little bit of detail in chapter 17 was that there would be a sign of this covenant. Many of the things said in chapter 17 are really just repetitions of these other times, but now there's the sign of circumcision that was made known to Abram, and we see his willingness to obey instantly. A beautiful spirit. If you had to summarize everything about Genesis 17, we spent a lot of time in it last week, I would say the entire chapter 17 of Genesis could be summarized in the word no five times. God is saying no to Abraham five times in this sense. No, Abraham, it's not Ishmael, it's Isaac. Abraham said, couldn't you just do this through Ishmael? He's 13 years old here. We're too old to have children. I've already got a child. No, it's not Ishmael, it's Isaac. The second no from God to Abraham. No, it's not Hagar, it's Sarah. Well, I took this second wife and she gave me a child. Isn't that good enough? No, it's Sarah. It is not Hagar. The third no. No, Abraham, it's not anything you can do. It's only something I can and will do. Well, we cooked up this plan, the Hagar syndrome. We had this baby. That's what you can do. No, it's not anything you can do. The whole plan of God is not anything people can do. It requires what God can and will do. Many miracles involved in bringing many sons unto glory. Many times the first fruits have to say, I just can't do that. I need God's help. I need God's power. I can't do it on my own. It's not by might or by power, but by your spirit. So that's the third no. It's not anything you can do. You and Sarah can do. I'm not going to do it that way. It's what I will do. And you'll have to realize that only I can do. The fourth no. No, it's not now. It's later. But when later comes, then it's forever. It's not now. Your descendants will have this land. In his lifetime, he really never became an owner of that land. It's for your descendants. Implicit in that is a resurrection because it's going to be a blessing to you and your descendants forever. Well, how can he enjoy the final fulfillment of this if he's dead? So implicit in that is the notion, if it's going to be forever, God's going to have to resurrect me. No, Abraham, it's not now. It's later. But when later comes, it'll then be forever. This is an endless blessing that I've given you. And the fifth no, no, it's not a little thing. It's a big thing. It's a very big thing. Like, if you can count all the grains of sand on all the shores of all the oceans, if you can count all the stars, that's how big it is. It's not a little thing. The plan of God. It's a very big thing. All right, now we come to chapter 18 with all of that review and all that background. So we have the terebinth through. We've commented on that. And it would appear that there were two primary reasons that what happened in chapter 18 happened. Let's read it. He lifted up his eyes, verse 2, and looked, and behold, three men were standing by him. Now when you just read that, it kind of gives you the sense that he hadn't seen them just coming over the horizon as little specks and then walking toward him and getting bigger and bigger, and like 30 minutes later they get there. That's not the sense you get. Look up, behold, like just opens his eyes and there they are. So already, if we had never read this chapter and we read that, unless you want to imagine that he's out there in the heat of the day and he nodded off to sleep as they're walking up, and then he opens up his eyes and there they are. But I don't think that's the sense of this. They're just there. They just, three people just there. Well, when we read the rest of the chapter, we shouldn't find that very difficult to believe, that that's the way it might have happened. He lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, they were just there, standing by him. And when he saw them, he ran from the tent door to meet them. They're just right out in front. And he bowed himself to the ground and said, "My Lord." Why? That seems a little strange. If these are strangers that just suddenly appear, why does he talk to them in this way, showing deference to them? You might just say, well, that's good hospitality. Maybe. But we almost get the sense early on that he knows there's something special about at least one of these visitors. He bows down. "My Lord, if I have found favor in your sight, do not pass by on your servant. Please let a little water be brought, and wash your feet, and rest yourselves under the tree. And I'll bring a morsel of bread that you may refresh your hearts. After that, you may pass by." So sometimes it seems like he's talking to one of the three, and other times to all three of them. "After that, you may pass by, inasmuch as you have come to your servant." And they said, "Do as you said." So Abraham hastened into the tent to Sarah and said, "Quickly, make ready three measures of fine meal, knead it, and make cakes." And Abraham ran to the herd, took a tender and good calf, gave it to a young man, and he hastened to prepare it. So he took butter and milk and the calf which he had prepared and set it before them, and he stood by them under the tree as they ate. What are we to make of all of that? Well, at bare minimum, what a good host and how much hospitality Abraham showed. Some people would say, well, that's just the way it is in the Middle East, and these people, they're hospitable, they don't have that many visitors or guests in this nomadic lifetime. Maybe, but it shows great hospitality. Hospitality is a good thing. It's something that is commended and even commanded in the Bible on numerous occasions. It's a fine and a wonderful character trait to have. Here we are in the South. It's known for Southern hospitality. Many of you, I know, are very hospitable, and that's a commendable thing. Just two or three places in the Bible where being hospitable, even to strangers, is commended and commanded. Romans chapter 12 is one such place in the New Testament. Look at that just a minute here. Romans 12. A series of miscellaneous but important exhortations to members of the church from the Apostle Paul. Not just for that day, but of course our day today. And it says in Romans 12 and verse 13, distributing to the needs of the saints, given to hospitality, pursuing hospitality. It's just a part of your character to be hospitable when those occasions arise. And then we go to Hebrews chapter 13. And I believe that this statement in Hebrews chapter 13 is directly referring to what we just read in Genesis 18. Again, it's exhortations in the Christian life to members of the church. Hebrews 13, verses 1 and 2. Let brotherly love continue, and do not forget to entertain strangers, for by so doing some have unwittingly entertained angels. So almost certainly, Paul, we believe, as he wrote Hebrews, was thinking about what we just read, the occasion where initially they looked like men, but he's entertaining angels, two angels and the one who became Christ, as we've gone through the story. Titus chapter 1 talks about the need to be hospitable for bishops or ministers of the church. Titus chapter 1 and verse 8, hospitable, a lover of what is good. Titus 1 and verse 8. Hospitable, a lover of what is good, sober-minded, just, holy, and self-controlled. So, and there are other occasions as well. So at bare minimum, we see Abraham's hospitality. I think personally that he is at least somewhat on to the fact that these are unusual visitors. You know, he had interacted with Melchizedek in an earlier chapter. So it's at least conceivable that he recognized. I'm not saying that dogmatically. I certainly couldn't prove it. But I think it's within the realm of possibility, having interacted with Melchizedek, who was a pre-incarnate manifestation of the one who became Christ, he might have noticed it. Anyway, we pick it up in verse 9, and we begin to see the reasons for this visit. It wasn't just to share a meal with Abraham. In fact, the emphasis is not on Abraham in this case. You remember last chapter when God reiterated in chapter 17 the terms of the covenant, he made it quite clear, one of those no's. No, it's not Hagar, it's Sarah. No, it's not Ishmael, it's Isaac. And back then he laughed. Maybe his weakness of faith was temporarily on display. Well, now who's going to laugh? Maybe we could conclude that one of the two reasons for this visit is to develop and work with the faith of Sarah. I think she already had faith, but it doesn't appear it's quite yet developed as it needs to be. She's mentioned in Hebrews chapter 11 as having faith, but we grow. We don't all have it all at once, and I think that's the case with Sarah. So let's read it. I think the emphasis here is on Sarah. Chapter 18 and verse 9 They said to him, "Well, where's Sarah, your wife?" They got after the meal, they went right to that question, which in that culture would have been somewhat unusual. It just different times, different traditions, but Sarah would not even have been out there with the men, or they thought were men. She would have been more in the background. And this would have been somewhat surprising for Abraham to hear this, that they said, "Well, where's your wife? Where's Sarah, your wife?" Abraham said, "Well, she's here in the tent. She's in the tent." Verse 10, he said, one of the three, is this just a man talking? "I will certainly return to you according to the time of life, and behold, Sarah, your wife, shall have a son." Who's going to return and perform that miracle for a 90-plus-year-old woman? Well, only God can do that. This has to be the one who became Christ doing the talking, appearing as a man, along with these other two who appeared as men, but were angels. "I will certainly return to you according to the time of life, and behold, Sarah, your wife, shall have a son." And Sarah was listening in the tent door, which was behind him. Now, Abraham and Sarah were old. Yeah, we already knew that from the last chapter. This probably happened right on the heels of the last chapter. Sarah had passed the age of childbearing. Had she not been aware of what happened in chapter 17? I think she was. But God is seeing to it that her faith has an opportunity to grow. If your faith needs to grow, what would step one be? Realizing it's not where it needs to be yet. If a person already thinks they have all the faith they ever need, what would encourage them to do whatever is necessary with God's help to have it grow? The first step is to realize, I don't have as much faith as I need. And this exchange brought that, bubbled it to the surface. Because what did she do? She laughed, just like Abraham had in disbelief last chapter. Sarah laughed within herself. She tried to stifle it, saying, "After I've grown old, shall I have pleasure, my Lord also being old? Is this really going to happen?" I said, Abraham earlier and now Sarah are going to have to choose. If God says something, are you going to believe it? Or are you going to believe your eyes in the present? You can live by sight, you can live by faith. Verse 13, so God, the eternal, see, it was a man, and then it was I doing miraculous things, and now it just says the eternal. So all doubt is removed who this is. Verse 13, the eternal said to Abraham, why'd Sarah laugh? Now, I've often wondered if I was in Abraham's shoes, why are you asking me why Sarah laughed? I got over my laughing last chapter. It's my fault that she's laughing? I don't know. I don't understand that fully. Maybe someday, but asks Abraham, why did Sarah laugh? Saying, shall I surely bear a child since I'm old? And here's one of the great questions of all time. Is anything too hard for God? I mean, that is just a profound question. Sarah, that's too hard? Sarah, do you believe you're the product of evolution? Well, no, I believe I'm a great-great-great-great-granddaughter of Eve. Well, where'd Eve come from? A rib from her husband. Where did he come from? The dust of the ground. So you believe God can take dirt and turn it into a human being. He can do that, and you don't think he can give you a baby. Think this through. Is anything too hard for the eternal? At the appointed time, I guess that means 9 months later, I will return to you according to the time of life, and Sarah shall have a son. And of course, Sarah did what sometimes people do. When they get caught and they're scared, they lie. Sarah denied it, saying, I didn't laugh, for she was afraid. And he said, no, you did laugh. You did laugh. Nobody can deceive God. He knows the hearts of people. So that's very important. If Sarah's faith needs to be developed, and I believe that was one of the purposes of this visit, step one would be for her to see that it's not yet as far along as it needs to be. Probably step two is to realize what's the underpinning of faith in God. It's to realize nothing's too hard for him. One key element of godly faith, maybe the main element of godly faith, is believing in God's power to accomplish whatever he sets out to do. That it's not too hard. Is anything too hard for God? A key element of godly faith is believing that God has the power to accomplish his will. It could be very simply put this way. Nothing which God, A, desires to do, and B, which he has revealed his intention to do, is too hard for him to do. If he said he wants to do it, and he intends to do it, he can do it. Because he has all power. It sounds so simple, but it underlies godly faith. It doesn't deny that what God has said can be done by him, and will be done by him. So God somewhat forcefully, there's gentleness here still, but somewhat forcefully, he says to Sarah, is anything too hard for me? Really, Sarah, is it? Anyone who is a chip off the old block, who is Christ's in Abraham, who is the spiritual seed of Abraham, must have developed within himself respect for God's power, belief in God's power to accomplish his will. And yes, we are told that God is going to do incredible things, including to that person in the mirror. That maybe is the greatest miracle of all. God can really do that? Yes, he can. So no one who is a fruit can believe in a weak God. And yet there's a lot of people who believe in a weak God. There's a lot of people alive today who believe in a weak God, especially today. The Bible talked about the end time. In 2 Timothy 3, let's read it. And one of the characteristics of the time in which we live is even religious people, let's read it, don't believe in God's power. 2 Timothy is clearly an end time prophecy. It says so in verse 1. 2 Timothy 3 and verse 1. Know this, that in the last days, surely we're there, perilous times, spiritually dangerous times will come. And then we go down and there's this long description of the kinds of things that people will believe and do and their character. And verse 5, they will have a form of godliness but deny its power. And that ties in with what Jesus said, doesn't it? When the Son of Man returns, will he find faith on the earth? How can you have faith if you doubt God's power to do what he has said he wants to do and will do? So we see God developing Sarah's faith. Well, I think that should be encouraging. If God is willing to go to all this trouble and patience with Sarah, and he's not a respecter of persons, maybe he'll do the same for you and me and be patient with us. But again, underlying godly faith is belief in God's power. And in the end time, there'll be many people that'll have a form of religion, but it won't have any power in it as far as they're concerned. All right, let's go back now, and we find the second reason for this visit. I think the first one was to develop Sarah's faith, just like they say of an alcoholic. An alcoholic cannot be cured until he first admits he has the problem. Well, a person cannot have their faith developed unless they first realize it isn't developed enough already. And her laughing, and this all came out, helped her to see, I need more faith. I need to quit doubting God's power. All right, so the second reason had to do with Sodom. The town down the road, the bright lights, the better pasture line outside the town where Lot wanted to go live. It looked better, more appealing. He left Abram back in the rougher area. Chapter 18, verse 16, let's begin that. Then the men, they looked like men, rose from there and looked toward Sodom. And Abraham went with them partway to send them on the way. Now, verse 17, and the Eternal said, shall I hide from Abraham what I'm doing? Well, that kind of strikes you, doesn't it? We're listening in on God coming to a decision. It's almost like he hadn't yet decided how much he should reveal to Abraham about what was just about to happen. I mean, that's what it says. The Eternal said, shall I hide from Abraham what I'm doing? And we see the process whereby God arrived at an answer that yes, he would reveal to Abraham. After all, this is my conduit. This is my man I've chosen to develop this whole plan. since Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, he's the one. Who else would I reveal it to? Who else would it be more logical to reveal these things to than the one who's going to be the start of this great plan? Abraham will surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him. So we see God just turning this over in his mind. For I have known him in order. Why did he know Abraham? That's an interesting verse. I've known Abraham. I've revealed myself to him. This is the fifth time since he's been in Canaan. There was one time prior to that. So we know of at least six times that God has communicated with this man. Why does he say the purpose is? Besides the plan. I have known him in order that he may command his children. There is quite a responsibility when God makes himself known to somebody, that somebody then passes on those things to the next generations. That's the way it reads, isn't it? I've known him so that, or in order that, he may command his children and his household after him. So the truth of God is not something that we just absorb and just keep to ourselves. And the church knows that it has a responsibility to pass the things on to the world by preaching the gospel. These themes we see are really just very important throughout all of God's working. I've known him in order that he may command his children and his household after him, that they keep the way of the eternal, to do righteousness and justice, that the eternal may bring to Abraham what he has spoken to him. So God, having, counseled with himself, you might say, he decides, I'm going to tell Abraham what's about to happen, what's happening here. So verse 20, and the Eternal said, because the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and because their sin is very grievous, I will go down now and see whether they have done altogether according to the outcry against it that has come to me, and if not, I will know. Now, I'm thinking a whole sermon could be given on those two verses because they raise some questions, and maybe we can't fully understand the answers. The secret things belong to God. If you just read that at a surface level, just taking the words as they are, it would sound like God had received reports, but he wants to go down and make double sure before he acts. And maybe that's all there is to it. But, and God has angels. It says the eyes of God, other times referred to as angels, go to and fro throughout the earth in order to show himself strong on behalf of those whose heart is perfect before him. So God has angels that are on the earth. And sometimes we see, like in the book of Job, they come up to heaven and give reports. Again, at a surface level, he's received reports, perhaps from angels, and he wants to just make double sure. So he manifests himself and brings two angels with him, and they go check it out. Maybe there's more to it than that. That's what it says on the surface. But he wants to be double sure. He wants to really be absolutely sure of the state of things in Sodom before he does something as important as wipe them all out in a universal judgment. This judgment that's possibly coming on Sodom would be very similar to what came on the whole earth in the days of Noah, when God looked down and he said it grieved his heart that he'd even made man on the earth. There was so much wretchedness and violence and sin. Well, anyway, that's what it says. I'll go down now and see whether they've done altogether according to the outcry against it that has come to me. And if not, I will know. I'm tempted to say, well, God already know? Well, I can't think that he doesn't. So, as I say, there, this may be just explaining it in terms that we could understand that overlays even deeper realities. I don't know. Some things are hidden from us to fully know. But this is what's revealed to us. All right, now verse 22. Then the men turned away from there and went toward Sodom. The men, which men? Well, the two that weren't the eternal. These two angels. Because in the next chapter, these two angels appear. What's these two that look like men now? So the two men turned away from there and went toward Sodom, and Abraham still stood before the eternal. So the one who is a manifestation of Christ doesn't go on toward Sodom. And verse 23, and Abraham came near and said, would, and he begins this, probably this most famous interview in history. He's interviewing and questioning God about what God's going to do to Sodom. Abraham came near and said, "Would you also destroy the righteous and the wicked? Suppose there were 50 righteous within the city. Would you also destroy the place and not spare it for the 50 righteous that were in it?" It's not one question, it's two. Abraham is asking two questions, not one. First of all, if there are some righteous there, and you've decided to destroy Sodom, do the righteous have to die along with the wicked? Do the righteous have to die along with the wicked? Secondly, if there's enough righteous, would you spare everybody and not even the wicked will have to be destroyed? Really two different questions. One's on, will the righteous be able to be spared under any case? And the other is, if there's enough righteous, will the wicked be spared this universal destruction? And he starts with 50. I have no idea why he started with 50. But he starts working it down. And he reminds God in a respectful manner. I think all of this has to do with his attitude. It's not a good thing to challenge God. Anybody that would go to God and challenge God like God is wrong and the person is right, that's never going to work. But we are seeing here that if a person in humility vocalizes what he understands about God's character and just kind of reminds God boldly, not arrogantly, but boldly, God will accept that. If there were 50, would you spare the 50 and would you spare the whole city? Far be it from you to do such a thing as this, to slay the righteous with the wicked. Abraham is saying, I believe I know you, that your ways are just and fair, not unfair. Far be it from you to do such a thing as this, to slay the righteous with the wicked, so that the righteous should be as the wicked, making no distinction between them. Far be it from you, shall not the judge of the earth do right. That sounds pretty bold, but I think it had everything to do with the attitude with which Abraham asked the question. And so the answer is, the Eternal said, if I find in Sodom 50 righteous within the city, then I'll spare all the place. So A, the righteous will live. B, so will the rest. Nobody will be destroyed in a universal destruction, at least not now. Then Abraham answered and said, indeed now I, who am I? I'm just dust and ashes. Again, the humility. I don't think I have a right to even have this discussion. But since you've allowed me this far, thank you. Can we go one step further? He's admitting, I'm not an equal with you. I'm just dust and ashes. I've taken it upon myself to speak to the Lord. Suppose there were five less than 50 righteous. 45. Same two questions. Can the righteous survive if you destroy the city? A second question, would you even spare the city of the wicked? Suppose there were... And he said, if I find 45, I'll not destroy it. Everybody lives. Then he spoke to him yet... This is the third time. What about 40? He's working it down so far by fives. 50, 45, 40. Same answer. If I can find 40, everybody lives. Verse 30. Please don't be angry with me, God. Please be patient. Suppose 30. Now an increment of 10. He's getting bolder. Maybe he knows his time is about up. 30. What about then? Same answer. Find 30, everybody lives. And he said, indeed, verse 31, I've taken it upon myself to speak to the Eternal, to the Lord. Suppose 20, another increment of 10. Same answer. Nobody is destroyed. One last time, verse 32. Let not the Eternal be angry, and I'll speak but once more. This is his last roll of the dice. He knows it. 10. If you could find 10, would the 10 live? Or would everybody live? And the amazing answer, I will not destroy it for the sake of 10. Now, what are you thinking when you read this? Why didn't he keep going? What about 5? Why not work it down to 2? Why not work it down to 1? I don't know. I have an idea. It's speculation. I'll label it as speculation. We'll get to that in a second. Every time I read it, I want him to keep going, but he doesn't. He knows something I guess I don't know, but he stopped at 10. He even called his shot. He says, this is my last shot. Well, if it's your last shot, why not go to 1 or 2? He stopped at 10. Why? I don't know, but I'll share at least one thought with you here in just a minute. That's an amazing interview. That's an amazing dialogue. It is usually not a good idea for a human being to question God in such a way that there is even a hint of criticism. God, you're doing the wrong thing. I know better than you. That is almost never a good idea. But you can get away with it, if I can put that in quotes, if you're like Abraham in chapter 18 of Genesis, and if you're like Moses in chapter 30-something of Exodus, when what you do is you preface it, God, this is what you have taught me about yourself. Let me just remind you what you have told me about yourself, and then under that umbrella, I'm going to ask the question. Moses did the same thing, and Abraham did the same thing. God, you're a merciful God. You're a patient God. We are weak and you're strong. We need. He reminded God, you're a just God. There is no unrighteousness with you. There is no injustice with you. If that is the attitude and the approach, not that I have some idea of how you should be, but this is how you've taught me that you are, and preface it that way, it apparently is something that God accepts. At least he did in this case. Would you buy this? In the wrong hands, this could have ended very badly. This interview could have ended very badly in the wrong hands, but it was in Abraham's hands. When a man approaches God from the point of view of the right point of view, good things can happen, and God's patience. If a man approaches God from an accusative point of view, it doesn't go well. Let me show you a few examples of that. We'll come right back here. Show you where it didn't go very well. When a person challenges God out of arrogance or pride or not the right humility, Job chapter 38. Contrast this with what we just read. All right, Job chapter 38, first couple of verses. Job is a righteous man, but there were just some things about the attitude, I think, that needed to be dealt with. This is Job 38, verse 1. The Eternal answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Prepare yourself like a man. I'll question you, and you will answer me. We don't see God answering Abraham that way. Well, that's because some of the things Job had said to God and about God were of a different flavor than what Abraham had just said. If we go to chapter 40 of Job, verse 1, moreover, the Eternal answered Job and said, shall the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? He who rebukes God, let him answer it. By this point, Job had realized that's not going to work. He says, I'm vile. I've said all I'm going to say. He had learned a very important lesson. Romans 9, verse 18. Yeah, it usually doesn't work out very well. It doesn't go as well as it did with Abraham when a person challenges God. And the underlying thought is, God, you're doing wrong, and let me tell you what you should do. That doesn't go well. It shouldn't go well because it's wrong. It's dark. God says, who is darkening this conversation with unwise words? But here's Romans 9 and verse 18. He has mercy on whom he wills, and whom he wills he hardens. God has made us. There is none righteous. I suppose in one sense we all deserve death. The wages of sin is death. Well, you will say to me then, you'll challenge God. Well, then why does he still find fault? For who has resisted his will? But indeed, O man, who are you to reply against God? That's the overall reality. Don't challenge God. Don't act like you're more righteous than God. That's not going to work. Who are you to reply against God? Well, the thing formed to say to him who made it, why have you made me thus? Does not the potter, God, have power over the clay, us, to do with what he wants? Yes, he does. But when a person is humble before God, as Abraham was, and is motivated by godly concerns, why did Abraham ask all these questions? He wasn't concerned about saving himself with these questions. He's actually concerned, can Sodom be saved? Not just Lot, not just the righteous. He's trying to, what is motivating him with these questions? He actually has concern, can Sodom be saved? God honors that. So when a person is humble before God and is motivated by godly concerns, unselfish thoughts, like, could mercy be even shown to these people? And if a person approaches God with a proper and humble attitude, this exchange can take place. And it did take place. I would summarize what we just read, this whole thing about Sodom and this exchange, with 7 summary points. And 1 or 2 of them, we'll come back to this point, why did he stop at 10? I'm not saying these are the only summary points, but I'll give you these summary points about what we just read in Genesis 18. Number one, as Abraham himself said, there is no injustice with God. That's what he prefaced his question. God, it's not, you're too righteous to do an unjust thing. There is no injustice with God. So that should be an absolute filter through which you and I think about whatever it is that God does with regard to anybody. Whatever God's doing, there is no injustice or unrighteousness with God. If it looks like there is, that's our fault, not God's. We're not understanding what's really going on. There is no unrighteousness or injustice with God. If you want to make a reference there, you could read Deuteronomy 32 and verse 4. That's point one. That comes out of this chapter 18. There is no unrighteousness or injustice with God. Deuteronomy 32, verse 4. Point number two, or summary point number two, God is patient. These things in Sodom had apparently been going on for some time. The hammer doesn't fall quickly. Sometimes it takes a long time. God is patient. These goings on in Sodom, it apparently happened for a long time. God gives people time to repent. He had let Assyria and Nineveh go a long time, and yet of all things, against all odds, Nineveh repented when God sent the prophet Jonah. We read clear back in Genesis 15 and verse 16, 3 chapters earlier, that there were a group of people that were very evil, and yet it was not yet time for God to punish them. It's the Amorites. It says their sin had not yet come full. This is Genesis 15, 16. In the fourth generation they shall return, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. They were living very sinful, wicked lives already. But it would be 3 or 4 more generations that God would tolerate that. And if there was no repentance, then they would be dispossessed and killed. So God is patient. That's point number two. We already saw that Abraham earlier didn't want anything to do with these people in Sodom. The king of Sodom came out and wanted an alliance. I don't want anything to do with you. So this sin had been going on for some time. Number three, mercy often triumphs over justice with God. God is perfectly just, but he's even more perfectly merciful. Mercy, a wonderful attribute, often triumphs over justice, another wonderful attribute with God. It says that in James 2:13. Mercy triumphs over justice. Way more than the other way. So it would have been very just for God to rain down fire and brimstone on Sodom and Gomorrah the first time he heard the report. He gave it time. He's going to check it out in detail again. Mercy on display, triumphing over justice. That was point three. Number four, Abraham knew that about God. He knew that mercy triumphs over justice often. And that, point four, that's what was motivating Abraham. He did not want to see the city destroyed. It's not that he didn't want the righteous to be destroyed. He didn't want the city to be destroyed. So he was finding out what would be the limits. What would be the minimum number of righteous that not only would the righteous survive, but so would the city. That was what was motivating him in these questions. He did not want to see the city destroyed unless there was simply no other way. Well, I think we see in Abraham God's character of wanting to give people time, mercy triumphing over justice. That was what was motivating all these questions. Point number five, I'm just calling the who knows. Like, who knows? The who knows point. I'll try to explain what I mean. The who knows. Here's Sodom, record, there for all to see. What is justice? Destroy them. But who knows? Maybe God's mercy could be extended a little bit longer. Who knows? Because of these other things we've seen. There are a number of times in the Bible where a righteous man says, who knows? It seems like we've reached the limit of things. It seems like God will be perfectly just in doing X, but who knows? Maybe it could even go a little further. Example, Exodus 32. Righteous men, not people who didn't know God, but people who did know God, say these things. Who knows? Maybe even now, mercy can triumph. We don't know for sure what the limits are. Look at Exodus 32 and verse 30, the golden calf incident. These people had seen miracle after miracle after miracle. Moses takes off and they fall into this orgy. Moses is mad. He knows God is mad. Verse 30, Exodus 32 and verse 30. Came to pass on the next day that Moses said to the people, you have sinned a great sin. If we stop right there, justice says you die. In fact, God had proposed that. They all die and we start over with Moses. You have sinned a great sin. So now I will go up to the perhaps, who knows? Perhaps I can make atonement for your sin. He wasn't sure, but he was willing to take it. Who knows? God's so merciful. Maybe even this can be remedied. Another who knows, 2 Samuel 12. We read this in another context. 2 Samuel 12. David, Bathsheba, the baby. What's justice? Severe penalties for David. One of them has already been named. The baby will die. But what's David thinking? I know that's what he said, but who knows? Maybe if I approach God humbly. So here we are, 2 Samuel 12, verse 22. And he said, while the child was still alive, I fasted and wept, for I said, who knows? Who can tell whether the Lord will be gracious to me, that the child may live? That's not an ungodly thought. That's a godly thought. Moses, David, they weren't sure. Maybe this time mercy won't triumph over justice, but who knows, unless, as he did, he fasted, he prayed, he besought God, and God said, no, this time, justice. He accepted that in humility. Joel, one of the minor prophets, chapter 2. You find who knows in a lot of books of the Bible from righteous men. Joel chapter 2, verse 12. A call to repentance. Joel 2, verse 12. Therefore, says the Eternal, turn to me with all your heart. With fasting and weeping and with mourning, rend your heart and not your garments. This is what David did. Return to the Lord your God, for he is gracious and merciful, slow to anger, of great kindness. He relents from doing harm. Who knows, verse 14, if he will turn and relent. That's not an ungodly thought. It's a godly thought. Need to wrap this up. You could also, if you want to make a note, there's a couple more who knows. Zephaniah 2 and verse 3. Zephaniah 2 and verse 3. And Amos 5 and verse 15. Amos 5 and verse 15. Point number six, summary point. Is there any way of knowing why Abraham might have stopped at 10? Well, he knew what had happened in the days of Noah. How many righteous were there that could be saved in the days of Noah? Were there even as many as 10? No, there were 8. There weren't even as many as 10. Noah, his wife, his 3 sons, 3 wives, that's 8. Maybe that was in his mind. I don't know, but it's a possibility that If there aren't at least 10, justice will have to be administered. There weren't even 10 in the days of Noah, and we see what happened. Universal destruction. I just put that out as a possibility. There were only 8, and maybe that was in his mind why he stopped at 10. And then point number 7. Even though it was God's judgment to destroy the city, those few who were righteous, and the bar in this case was pretty low to get over the bar of saying he was righteous, Lot, we see what Lot did leading up to this and even later. Lot's 2 daughters, we see what they did later. That's not a very high bar to say those were the righteous ones, if you know what I'm saying here. But God said, those are righteous enough, I'll save them, and they were saved. That goes back to that first question. Do the righteous have to die with the wicked? The 3 that were righteous, that God was willing to save, Lot and his 2 daughters, the offer was made to Lot's wife. She turned back. The offer was made to Lot's 2 sons-in-law. They made fun of him. Sometimes the bar is pretty low. Maybe that encourages us. I don't know. Because God is patient even with the righteous in their weaknesses, and they can be saved. Last verse of the day, 1 Peter 4:18, in light of that, probably in light of what we'll look at next time, but Lot and his 2 daughters, they got delivered. How high is the bar? 1 Peter 4 is just food for thought. God knows even the righteous have their weaknesses, and he's patient. It says it this way in 1 Peter 4:18, now, if the righteous one is scarcely or barely saved, what will be the ungodly and the sinner? What will be their fate? We'll try to pick it up next time.